You're listening to a podcast of The View, brought to you by the Church of the Larger Fellowship. To find other episodes of The View and to subscribe to this podcast, visit questformeaning.org/VUU.
Good morning. You've joined us for another episode of The View. I'm Meg Riley, today in beautiful Montecito, California, the Santa Barbara area, with no complaints whatsoever. Today we're delighted to have Reverend Dr. Bill Schultz, the head of the Unitarian Universalist Service Committee, and Reverend John Crestwell from Awake Ministries, come and talk to us about a new film that's going to be released in the fall, a Ken Burns documentary about Martha and Wadesil Sharp. This is here to talk about a documentary which I should say you're not involved in making that documentary, but the Unitarian Universalist Service Committee is certainly intimately involved with the story that's being told in that documentary. So, Bill, if you'd start by just describing Martha and Wadesil Sharp and what was going on and what they did and how the service committee was involved, just start assuming that people know nothing about this.
Well, thanks, Meg. It's really a pleasure to be here with you on The View. Thank you for inviting me. This is a remarkable story, and I think the degree of its remarkableness, as it were, is reflected in the fact that the great producer Ken Burns has picked up the story and is now going to be telling it in a production that will be released October 16th, The Sharp's War, and it will expose and educate people about these remarkable events and these remarkable individuals and, not incidentally, about Unitarian Universalism and the Service Committee. So the time is February 1939, probably a few weeks before that, when Frederick May Elliott, who was then president of the American Unitarian Association, was in the process of trying to recruit one or two ministers or other people to go to Europe to begin rescuing those whom he knew were victims of Nazi aggression. And he asked 17 people, 17 ministers, before he could get anyone to agree to go. And the people who agreed to go were the Reverend Wadesil Sharp, who was then minister of the church in Wellesley Hills, Massachusetts, and his wife, Martha Cogan Sharp. And the two Sharps, though they had two small children at the time, agreed to set out in February of 1939 for Europe. Now, I think it's not only remarkable that they agreed to do this, particularly given the family obligations that they had, but the timing of this, I think we need to think back on how courageous this is and how prescient it was. Because February of 1939 was less than 3 months after the Kristallnacht, so-called Kristallnacht, when Jewish stores and synagogues were trashed all over Germany. But it was long before the Nazis required Jews in Germany to give up their gold and silver. It was long before the so-called Pact of Steel with Italy. It was long before the occupation of Czechoslovakia. It was long before people knew of Auschwitz. February of 1939 is when the Sharps felt deeply enough about this that they were willing to leave their two small children, to leave Wadesil's church in Wellesley Hills, and to go to Europe without really knowing what the results would be.
Bill, and I'm really curious. Why do you think that is really prescient, and how do you think they knew, how do you see the behind the scenes that not just them, but the Unitarian Service Committee and the UUA, or the AUA, how did they know? Who were they in relationship with that led them to this ask? I'm always curious about the behind the scenes organizing.
Right. Good question, Meg. I don't know the details of that, but of course the American Unitarian Association had been involved since 1901 in the International Association of Religious Freedom, which had members all over Europe, but had liberal Protestants in Germany itself. The American Unitarian Association and its president, Frederick May Elliott, was certainly someone who had a global view of events, who paid close attention to what was happening. There was information that was beginning to surface at that point about exactly what was going on in Germany. And I think that it was a matter of paying attention. And I think we can feel that at the best of times, at least, has been typical of Unitarians and Universalists, simply that they paid attention to what was going on, but more importantly, that they were willing to be involved, to physically be involved at a date when far fewer people than ultimately wanted to be involved in this, long, of course, before the entry of America into the United States into the war. They wanted to be involved in this way. In any case, they did go to Europe. They went twice over the next year or year and a half. And I won't give away all the surprises, but it's a very dramatic story in which they escorted people across the Pyrenees Mountains to Lisbon and then by boat to freedom. Later, they established themselves in Czechoslovakia. Shortly before the German occupation of Czechoslovakia, they were involved in trading currency. They were involved in what we would today, I think, call undercover work of one kind or another. Their lives were certainly in jeopardy. It's a very dramatic and brave, a story of bravery that we can be very proud of, and that ultimately resulted in the founding of the American of the Unitarian Service Committee. The Universalists had a different structure, and the two eventually merged. But this was ultimately what resulted, along with the work of other people like Robert Dexter and Charles Joy, in the founding of the Unitarian Service Committee.
And I wish I were feigning ignorance at this minute. I'm glad I'm not at the MFC. Didn't the Flaming Chalice have something to do with this as well?
Well, Hans Deutsch, yes, was the one who created the Flaming Chalice later as a symbol of hope. And that symbol was eventually adopted by the Unitarian Service Committee and, of course, eventually by the association at large. And interestingly enough, you know, that symbol, we often don't recognize that at least the legend is that Jan Hus, who was a Czech religious liberal, a dissenter, when Jan Hus was put to the flames for his religious dissent, he is alleged to have said, now one has to understand that in Czech the word hus means goose, he is alleged to have said, today you cook a goose, but the fat and the flames from that goose will live forever. And that symbol of flame and of freedom was at least allegedly part of the inspiration for Hans Deutsch's design of the chalice.
I love that story. Whether it's true or not, we wish we would all...
It's a good story. We wish we'd
be that cool when being wrong in the state.
And one of the amazing things, too, is that, you know, of course, that started off the Hussite Wars, which went on for 100 years, and that people, the Hussites, had flags that had... some had flaming chalices on them, and some had... a big picture of a goose on it, and as a part of me, you know, and actually still in the Moravian Church, which is the antecedent of the is that right? Is that right? The word, the right word? The child of Hus's church in America, but you'll see flaming chalices on their robes and clothes. They're still in the Czech Republic.
I went to a concert in a downtown church in Prague, an old church, and it turned out to be a modern, functioning Hussite church, still active, and it had in English a list of their principles, and it was clearly liberal religious within a kind of Catholic frame, but still active, and like most liberal churches, a great music program and a building in somewhat disrepair, but it was still going, and I brought home some pamphlets and literature about the modern Hussites, which are still going strong. Well, maybe not strong, but they're still going.
I was in the Jan Hus Presbyterian Church in New York City, and said, "What do you mean Presbyterian? He was a Unitarian. He was a Moravian." Obviously, an inspiring guy. No, I'm joking. I'm not feigning that much. That I'm feigning. But let's get back to the topic at hand here. I'm really interested in Martha Sharp. I mean, that was an unusual enough brave thing for a male minister to do, but for a mother of young children, I am guessing that there was some anxiety in the system about that decision that she made.
Oh, I think there's no question about that. And as we know, and as told in this story, the Sharps ultimately separated and divorced afterwards. Obviously, I don't know the details of that, but I think there was indeed great tension, to the extent to which it was a tension that was a result of this travel and these brave acts, I don't know, but it's certainly true. Martha then, of course, really came into her own. She ran for Congress, though unsuccessfully. She was deeply involved in many social justice causes until the end of her life. And she is a great heroine to us and was indeed active in the Unitarian Universalist Service Committee up until her death. So she is an absolutely remarkable person. And we owe this entire story, at least grand, eloquent expression through Ken Burns, we owe it to the grandson of Waitstill and Martha Sharp, Artemus Jukowski. Artemus has been pushing for this story to be told, I don't know, at least for a decade, maybe more. He's been relentless. He is stubborn. He is intent and eloquent about his grandparents, and he has made this happen. I think that he had a friendship or a connection of some kind with Ken Burns and eventually persuaded Ken Burns to be engaged in this. And obviously, October 16th and all that follows that, as well as all that precedes it, will, I think, make a real difference in terms of the extent to which Unitarian Universalism is known beyond our relatively modest audience.
Yes, Artemus is certainly devoted to having Unitarian Universalism central in this story. I wanted to mention that the Yad Vashem, the first time I ever went to the Holocaust Museum, it was back in the 90s when, Bill, you'll remember, we were doing it together. The religious right was really on the ascent here. And so I started with, I want to see the resistance. And I went to the end first to see where the resistance was. And I was shocked by how little there was, how little resistance was documented. But some people are lifted up. And can you describe that? I know it was before your time at the service committee, but the elevation of the Sharps by the Jewish community and...
Yes, indeed. So the Sharps are two of only three Americans who are honored at Yad Vashem as so-called righteous among the nations. And Yad Vashem is, of course, the Holocaust memorial and museum in Israel. And there was a very moving ceremony at which Martha Jukowski, Artemis's mother and the Sharps' daughter, attended and spoke a number of years ago. I think that Charlie Clements, my predecessor, was present there as well. The Sharps are also pictured and honored at the U.S. Holocaust Museum, and we had a very moving ceremony when a picture and their story was put on the walls there as well. The Jewish community has certainly embraced the Sharps, and we were, last April, we held here in Boston area, the 75th anniversary celebrations for the service committee, and we were very honored that four of the survivors, and they were of course children at the time, but four of them were with us, and they have led remarkable, distinguished lives thanks to Waitstill and Martha Sharp.
So once they arrived here, were Unitarians or Universalists engaged with relocation, and how did the story continue after the folks were brought, the children primarily were brought to the U.S.?
Well, now you're getting beyond my knowledge.
Give away the story, okay?
I don't know. That's a very good question, and maybe John Cresswell will be able to help us with that.
Okay, all right.
I presume that that was the case, though I know that that they were also involved with other public agencies when they reached this country and elsewhere.
Yeah, I'm sure that they are. John Crestwell, by the way, if you're viewing this live, is on his way and says he'll be here. And poor Bill, we were supposed to be transitioning to these questions that are more in John's. But I want to ask a Bill Schultz question, because you are the Unitarian Universalist human rights person to ask this. So Bob mentioned the white supremacists coming to Buffalo. Certainly there have been people, including Anne Frank's relatives, who have compared this presidential candidate that we have in this ascent of the far right here to pre-Nazi Germany. What do you think is a useful way? I don't like to exaggerate and call everybody a Nazi, but what do you think is a useful way to reference this time that we're in the United States, learning from history, including many other places as well, but also I think Nazi Germany is our go-to place for referencing this kind of abuse of power.
Yes, I think we have to be cautious about that, Meg. I remember when I was at Amnesty International and Amnesty declared that Guantanamo Bay was the gulag of our times, making an analogy to the Soviet prison camps. And the Washington Post and many others objected strenuously and said, look, thousands and thousands of people died in the gulag, and is that truly an appropriate metaphor? And in some ways it was, and in some ways it wasn't. So I think it's important not to immediately rush to the Holocaust as the appropriate metaphor for every political position with which we disagree. I think that there's no question, however, that metaphors or analogies, I should say, to McCarthyism and to other elements within American history, what the great political scientist Richard Hofstadter called the paranoid style in American politics, is being manifest here. We've seen the emergence of these kinds of so-called populist movements, anti-establishment movements, throughout American history. And sometimes, as now, they've been tinged with racism, and sometimes they've been seen as literally more grassroots uprisings. And I think this is a dangerous period for American culture and political life. It's a period that calls for Unitarian Universalists and all those who care about progressive politics and who want to stand against nativism and racism to be outspoken about that. There's no question that it's a dangerous time. But I too would hesitate to move, at least at this point, to an analogy with the Holocaust.
I imagine some of the trying to bring in the Holocaust is, it's easy and it's inflammatory. And I imagine that for some people there's also this worry of, is this how it begins? Like, are we going to look back at this time and, what should we be doing? And so going back to the documentary, I know this is coming out through PBS. Is this something that you think can be used educationally in our schools or something as a model for how ordinary people can really make a difference?
Absolutely. Thank you for that question. Absolutely. And Artemis has been very intent upon this. He's linked with Facing History and Ourselves. There will be various curricula that will be produced and provided in conjunction with this film. And the film itself and all of the education and marketing around it emphasize that this is a story that is relevant for our day. There's absolutely no question about that. And I think what we're eager to see, certainly at UUSC and through the UUA, is using this as an opportunity not just to tell people about Unitarian heroes, but to inspire people to be engaged in ways that may not be comparable to the Sharps. We can't all leave our children and go overseas and work with the Rohingya in Burma, for example, or work with the refugees in Croatia or in Greece, though some of us are able to do that. And of course, the service committee works to provide opportunities for people who can, but not all of us can. But we can all be engaged with these issues, and we can all support institutions that are engaged with them, whether it be our local congregations or the service committee of the UUA or organizations well beyond Unitarian Universalism. And for me, that's one of the lessons of the Sharps. The Sharps are a model. They did this remarkable thing themselves. We can't all do that, but we can all be engaged, particularly through institutions, in standing against this kind of tyranny. And certainly if the future results politically in this country put into power people who then begin to threaten the news media, for example, and to threaten political opponents of whatever stripe, and we begin to see some of the precursors of not just of Nazism, but of totalitarianism in any culture. And of course, Nazism was one, but by no means the only instance in world history in which we see and continue to see today oppressive policies that are targeting particular groups of people. And we there certainly is a reason to believe that danger may come to this country with the nativism and anti-immigrant sentiment that is being expressed in this campaign.
Are you hopeful that this will get people to look at the plight of refugees? And right now, of course, our brain goes to Syria, but this is something happening in so many countries. Are you hopeful that the documentary will kind of shape how people look at that?
No question about that. The analogy to many of the refugee situations and to the situation with immigrants here in this country, I think we need to underscore that as well, because the detention of immigrant women and children in prison conditions here in this country is itself reflective of that kind of fear of the stranger, of failure to embrace our neighbors. So this is a major point of this documentary at this point, is to say this story is ongoing, not necessarily, of course, with Nazis and brave people from this country rescuing people from Nazis, but it is certainly ongoing in all sorts of instances around the world.
I think we all like a narrative, especially one where the U.S. is the heroes and liberates, you know, and so we've all kind of been fed that narrative. I wonder if you, Bill, might share some other narratives that you're currently engaged with at the Service Committee. I know that the College of Social Justice has been taking people places. We've had a whole show about the border trips and in the U.S., Mexican border, and I'm curious what you've seen about the development of moral courage by the kind of ordinary people who go on those trips and why those trips make a difference.
Well, thanks for that, Meg. There's the College of Social Justice is just a remarkable institution. We're continuing not only to take people to the border, but we continue to take people to Haiti. We have a delegation from Shelter Rock that is going to Haiti next week. And going to a place like Haiti is a profoundly moving experience. It's a challenging experience. It challenges our sense of our dominant culture. It challenges, given the history of Haiti and the relations with the United States and the way in which American corporations and governments have exploited Haiti as well as elsewhere in the Caribbean and Latin America, it challenges us. It tells a different narrative. But what is so interesting about Haiti is that it is also telling a narrative of Haitian entrepreneurship, and it is attempting to change the narrative of Haitians as victims or as Haitians as corrupt, these kinds of stereotypes that we have of Haitians, or as Haitians as simply poor people who do nothing but suffer. Well, there certainly is truth to the fact that there's corruption in Haitian society, no question about that, that Haitians have been victims of exploitation, but the Eco Villages and our other partners with whom we work in Haiti, including those who are now attempting to address the expulsion of Haitians from the Dominican Republic, these narratives are telling stories of Haitian resilience. They are telling stories of Haitian imagination, a commitment to create a new form of agricultural, of a sustainable agriculture, of sustainable living in the face of a humanitarian crisis. And that's a narrative in that case that needs to be told. And the narratives, of course, on the border in the American Southwest and in San Antonio, where we are working with immigrant women and children, refugee women and children there, is also an important narrative to be told about neighborhoods, about our neighbors, and about why are people coming to this country, and what role has the United States played in creating the conditions in Central America around drug policy, or in Mexico around trade and economics, that is pushing people to seek refuge here in this country.
And so, when somebody goes on one of those trips, Bob's described how it transformed him. We've heard your story, Bob. We'll hear it again. But Bill, you've talked to a number of people before and after, and I'm curious. Do you think that trips like that build more moral courage? And then how do people, when they come back, do something with that?
One of the key commitments of the College of Social Justice is that all those who go on the trip are asked to design ways in which, when they come home, they will be able to translate their experience to their home contexts. So that is, we are not interested in just one-off experiences here. We're interested in really embedding within people's minds and hearts a new way of looking at the world. And to go, I've been to Haiti twice now, to go to Haiti, to work side by side with our Haitian brothers and sisters there, to move those rocks, to build those that community center and that school and those houses, to go into the fields and to see the new forms of agriculture within the context of this society is to recognize that this kind of resilience that I spoke about can be translated into any context, that it exists there if the structures are created to allow it to flourish. And that, of course, is what UUSC is certainly trying to do, not just in Haiti or in Texas, but to build, through our new justice building program, to build skills for everyone to create structures that will encourage people to be able to live their full expression of their humanity.
You know, I'll lift up. I worked with the service committee closely after Hurricane Katrina. I was the UUA's point person and worked closely with the people who really knew disaster relief, which is something I still know very little about, but I was so impressed by the deep commitment to the forgotten ones, to the people on the edges, and the years since then have just borne out my real deep pride in the knowledge of the staff there to look beyond rhetoric and look beyond the superficial kind of feel-good response to catastrophe and really look at how to bring justice into that mix. And so it excites me that all these other people are getting that same exposure I got to, like, the complexity and also the real pride that we can take in the very cutting-edge work of the service committee. I imagine that you know many, many contexts in which you have seen just what I saw in New Orleans.
Meg, that's all very general to me. Can you just flesh out what it is? What does it mean to look for the forgotten ones in a disaster relief situation?
Sure. Well, we were funding groups led by people of color. We were funding groups for LGBT people of color. We were looking at the people who the Red Cross or the Salvation Army or the evangelical churches, who ended up with a whole lot of the federal money, were not going to care for. Mm-hmm. And the people who were doing political and power analysis of what happened. Because it wasn't, and they're never just a natural disaster. There were all these political players in the mix. And so we had people who were kind of doing what they're doing in Haiti, not just being receptacles of money and victims, but really we're going to take that and create something and have ownership of it. And, you know, one of the people we funded started something similar in terms of building houses very cheaply for a whole village of people in a community center. And this was outside of New Orleans, out in the country, but people doing amazing work like that where they weren't just like, oh, the lucky recipients of, you know, the rain falling from heaven, but we're really claiming the context. And also the real political organizers in the city who saw what was happening with the government, you know, funding the casinos to come back in or turning the schools into charter schools and just, you know, really fighting some of that oppression that and that takeover that Katrina allowed the rich white people to have in the wake of that horrendous event. So that's in New Orleans, but Bill would know that globally. Well,
thank you.
So Tom, I think what's important to see is that the power dynamics that are in play before a disaster are in play after a disaster.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And what that means is that the people who call the shots in any society are the ones who influence where most of the aid and assistance is going to go. Mm-hmm. So in Nepal, for example, after the horrendous earthquake there, caste groups, lower caste groups, women, LGBT community, these were the last to receive assistance because they didn't have any power before the earthquake.
Mm-hmm.
And to the extent to which international agencies come in and rely upon local officials rather than going to the grassroots to make decisions about the distribution of assistance or long-term commitments for rehabilitation and renovation, they are going to be making those decisions primarily for the people who already have certain advantages and mm-hmm. who are not themselves marginalized. So that's why in a disaster, if the Red Cross or USAID or Catholic Charities or any of the big agencies are already working with populations, UUSC is less likely to mm-hmm. work with those particular populations. We want to find people in the disabled community, for example, or, as I say, the LGBTQ community, or often it's women still in many of these developing societies whose economic interests are not taken seriously by the powers that be. So that's what we mean by always targeting the most marginalized.
Thank you. That's very helpful.
Well, I'm reminded of just last week we had Leslie Mack on, who's been doing work in Flint, and the water distribution system there is run by the National Guard, and if, for folks who are undocumented, they're extremely uncomfortable walking into that setting and getting the water they need to stay alive. So talk about the forgotten people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And Flint, of course, was the entire city was forgotten until recently.
Bill, you made getting back to the documentary, you had made the point that, look, obviously not everyone can be like the Sharps and leave, you know, home and family to go do something. And something that I've been thinking a lot about is like incremental change and tiny little things that we can do, because I think that we can see on the other side, and the pro-life movement, I think, is a perfect example of how incremental changes really can make a huge difference for good or for bad. Here in Texas, you know, an example is that we had a court last year who said, no, you can't jail children. You know, like, this is not a good thing. And so now, to get around that, people are trying to work it that these detention centers can be licensed as child care centers. And so there are a lot of people here trying to, you know, it's a small thing that has a huge impact. There are a lot of people trying to fight against that. Are there other ways that you think of where this kind of, call it mouse bite activism, really can make a difference?
You know, I'm so glad you made that point. I often underscore exactly what you're saying. This is the way norms change, and I could give dozens of examples. They change with slow, steady, simple changes, often at the grassroots level, that multiply. And that multiplier effect then may lead to changes in law, which then leads to further changes in norms. And I'll give you one of my favorite examples is the decisions in the early 2000s by the Supreme Court with regard to the death penalty as it applied to juveniles and to people with mental disabilities. You know, we never thought that those decisions would come down from the court as it had been structured. But for years beforehand, people at the local level had been working with their city councils to get them to pass resolutions about the fact that the execution of juvenile offenders was a violation of not only of international law, but of all human rights standards. They were getting their state legislatures to gradually move to outlaw that in their particular states. And eventually, when the issue came to the Supreme Court, what did the Supreme Court say were the grounds for it changing its opinion on the constitutionality of those executions? It said, prevailing public opinion has changed around this issue. And what does that mean? How does public opinion change? It changes by those little steps that you've just described at the grassroots that eventually become a wave that overtakes the resistance that has been long established. So I couldn't appreciate more what you've just said in that respect, or underscore how important it is for people to know that and to keep the faith around that. I know that it's difficult when we don't see victories right away. And these are long, you know, Spinoza said, always take the view from eternity. We're not going to get all of these changes made in our lifetimes. But to chip away at those things, that's what faith is all about, and that's what religious social justice is all about as well. So thank you for making that point.
So what's one of your favorite, if you ran, you know, the lives of Unitarian Universalist social justice activists, and you could say there's one mousebite activism thing that would really help right now? Or, okay, I hate it whenever people say one.
I'm not going to rise to that.
A few. But what do you see people not, like, little things that people could be doing that from your perspective? Because to me, the international situation seems so big and far away and overwhelming that I often just stay domestic because I can't figure out how to have any impact in international human rights. And so what are small things that, besides supporting the service committee, which I heard, what are small things that we could be doing to change the culture, what Joanna called mouse bite activism?
Well, rather than answer that right away, Meg, I want to question one of your premises, because I think it's important to understand that what we do domestically has a huge influence internationally. Sometimes it's direct and sometimes it's indirect, but it has a profound influence. And this was reinforced to me over and over when I was at Amnesty International, that the United States' own domestic practices, whether they be policies or whether they simply be the way in which we carry on our daily life, is followed intimately and conscientiously by both our adversaries and our allies. And I can't emphasize how much damage, for example, to American foreign policy interests is being done by the current political debate and what I've referred to as the nativism, the racism that we see reflected here. It has enormous.
Where'd Bill go?
John popped on and Bill left.
Wait, there's a little black buck. No, that should be Bill at the edge. But
hey, John.
Hi, John.
Hello, beautiful people. How's everybody?
That's great. I wonder, huh? Well, we've been joined by John Crestwell. Another day in technology. Bill was just in that emotional mountaintop of a compelling Bill Schultz kind of mini.
He's probably still going on, but on somebody else's page.
It could be. That was actually very helpful. Well, John, I'm so glad you're here. We've been deferring the questions about, so this great documentary is going to come out, and you're working, I know, on getting it out to Unitarian Universalists and what we should do with it when it comes out and all of that. So why don't you talk a little bit about how it happens that you're doing that and what you're up to. And everybody, this is Reverend John Crestwell from Awake Ministries.
Yeah, so I met Artemis, one of the directors, with Ken Burns. I met him through Sharon Welch at Meadville. And I'd started doing some affiliate teaching there here recently, and Artemis and I had some conversations. And one thing just led to another, and he knows I'm a UU evangelist, and so he said, well, can you evangelize and get this film out? It's going to be, the information about this film, it's going to be huge. And so the thing I think we finally settled on is a name. You probably have been seeing like four or five different names. The name of the film is Defying the Nazis, The Sharps War. That is the official, as of last week, that is the official title of the film. They expect it to air in the early fall, in the evening. I can't tell you the date that it has been given to me, to maybe 30 million households.
Bill said October 16th. Is that maybe not final anymore? It keeps changing, I know.
Right now, okay. It's now in September. And I can say it'll be at 9 p.m., but I can't give you the exact date. It could fall back to October, but as of my latest conversation with Artemis, that's what I know. He mentioned there's going to be a book that will accompany the...
No, we really didn't ask him much about how it will be received and what people can do with it, because we knew okay. That was what you knew about, so you could talk about that.
Yeah, so we're hoping that we get this out to all 1,000 of our UU congregations. And let's see, what we're hoping you guys will do are viewing parties, which may be a little bit difficult if you don't have cable in your church, but you could do it over someone's house, maybe a member who has a big house. Once that date is known, maybe gather around, have some potluck, and then a few beverages, and then enjoy the film. It's really compelling. It really will have the hairs on your back standing up at one point, and really show you the courage that it takes, and also the toll that this kind of stress can take on people, which will make great conversations. So some house parties. But also utilize the film to set up some interfaith conversations. You know, find your local imam, your local rabbi, and you know, all of you guys get together and watch some clips, or utilize the book that Beacon Press is putting out, and then have some conversation. Invite the community, because you know the way to bring people out is to bring a gathering of different folk out, whether it be all Christians or an interfaith group, and have them bring their people. So everybody kind of brings their people to the table, and then have some really hard conversation about evil, maybe, about, as I said, the toll that that social justice can take on a couple. Maybe do some, have conversations on self-care, sacrifice. There are a number of ways that you can do utilize the film. You're going to get some help, though, because UUA is putting together an interfaith toolkit. It should be ready by General Assembly to kind of be tested. And that will be able to be utilized by that's sort of an outside piece to help you to actually do social justice, how the film inspires you to do good works.
Will there be a screening of the film at GA? Do you know?
Right now, we did not get the workshop. Don't know why. I'm shocked, it's especially because I know some workshops that were accepted.
And the only thing we won't go into that.
Tell us about that.
Yes.
The only thing I can come up with is...
Joking.
Yeah. The only thing I can come up with, Meg, is that... it's so big that they felt maybe it didn't need the help of General Assembly. And I know that sounds silly, but that's all I could come up with. You know, it only promotes Unitarianism, too, you know, and not Universalism.
Okay. Well, but it seems like this is such an opportunity for congregations to reach out. Is there truth to the rumor that the Obamas are going to screen this movie?
That's the hope. You can't guarantee that. There's a letter being written coming from Peter Morales and Bill Sanford, asking the president to watch the film. and to maybe even come be a part of that night when it happens. There's a lot of stuff going on behind the scenes that that Artemis producers and all those things are doing. There'll be, you know, like in Hollywood, they have these big screening parties and the day of the event. It's going to be all you know, glitz and glamour, and that's all wonderful. But for us, for us, it's putting our name out there, unlike it's been for, what, 100 years? I mean, you know, it's been a long time since people really...
Yeah, how many people watch a Ken Burns documentary? Like, hundreds of millions? I mean, it's a big number to hear.
It goes from anywhere from 20 to 100 million people.
Yeah.
So I can't fathom that many people.
Yeah.
You know, and it'll air several times, not just once. And then, of course, there'll be DVDs, and there'll be, you know, there'll be lots of ways that people can connect. And I think every church should be ready for this and be ready to have some type of event where they can take advantage of the publicity. You know, the two things we're going to provide for you are the Interfaith Toolkit from the UUA that will be probably available online, and then Meville Lumber is creating a, through the FOS initiative, some type of religious exploration kit. So imagine classes, religious education classes for adults and children that relate to the story. Those are the two major things that we have. And, of course, we're going to be sending the clip out to all the congregations. So it'll probably come through your administrators.
So we don't know when we'll even know the final date then, but sometime in September.
Yeah, as soon as I know, you'll know.
Yeah. How would people stay in touch as things unfold about this? How would they know, you know, what would be the easiest way for people to know when that screening date is and to brainstorm with each other how to... Do you have a Facebook group?
No, maybe that's a good idea.
Yeah, because I think people could share ideas with each other about how they're going to use the film.
That's a brilliant idea.
Yeah.
I hadn't thought about that. We haven't figured that part out yet. We should, but that's a good idea.
Well, I'm so excited. It is such an inspiring story. You know, having living here in the Boston area and having been to the Wellesley Hills Church, and see, you know, and you see these photos of these, you know, kind of regular looking folks with, let me just say, an amazing name. Waitstill is just like such a great old Puritan name, you know. But and sort of saying, and I think it's just it's inspiring. I think for any of us to sort of say, wow, like these people made a huge difference in not just the lives of the people whom they helped, but I think in their church, you know, for us now, but also really made a huge difference at a time when the world seemed really dark and really evil. I shouldn't say dark, but really evil. And it's a fantastic story, and I'm so pleased. You know, having spoken to Artemis in the past, you know, knowing that it's gotten to this point is just, it's mind-boggling.
It really is.
John, operating on the hope that this documentary will drive some, you know, people through our doors, is there, and not just people, you know, looking for the stereotypical place where you can believe whatever you want to believe. If they're being guided by this documentary, I believe they're going to have different motivations. Is there any internal work that you hope congregations will do in preparation for these people coming through our doors?
Yeah, that's a whole nother question, not related to the film, you know, but related to my understanding of ministry. And you know, you use kind of sometimes feel they've already made it to the mountaintop, and that's not true. We've still got a lot of work to do around how to build relationships with people, how to see people, how to recognize people as people, how to not prejudge people, and how to truly be welcoming. And every church should be practicing how to be welcoming. I mean, you know, how to be welcoming in general to anybody, how to be hospitable. Your church, in a way, when people come over, it's like inviting people over your house. And to me, it's easy for us to go out in the community and do work, but to do the work inside your community, to me, is the real work, because you're inviting people to come over your house and become a part of your family, so to speak. And we haven't done a great job of that. And this is not a story about that. But inevitably, even if this story reached a billion people, if we're not ready on the inside in our buildings, it might do damage to our church, to our churches, if you think about it, because people come in and they want to come in and celebrate the God of their understanding, and they get pushed away by some ultra-rational, hyper-rational person, and they'll be turned off. You know, we still have a lot of work to do in our churches to become truly inclusive and, you know, not Christian bashing, but truly inclusive. And what I see is becoming really our spiritual centers. You know, it's a place you go, yeah, you can worship, but you can do yoga, you can go do some mindfulness. You know, we're a spiritual center. And you can't walk into a spiritual center and hear Christians being made fun of, or Jesus being belittled, or whatever. So we got some work to do, Joanna.
We're all shaking our head, and I think all of us can also think of like places where it's been not the rationalist, but other folks who just sort of will scare folks away because they don't fit in. Folks don't assume they're going to be able to fit in because of whatever their culture is, that sort of thing. So,
well, what I'm seeing, I don't know what you're saying out there, Hank, but there's a new generation coming forward now. They're not baby boomers. Some of them are, but mm-hmm. They're Generation X, and they're, you know,
millennials, yeah.
And they have families. They're young. I don't see the same baggage that I came in with baggage. I'm Generation X, but I came in with baggage. I came in angry with Christianity. I got over it though. You know, it's not there anymore. But yeah. I don't even see that with these new people coming in. When I engage them, the same cynicism is just not there.
Yeah.
And the use of God or spirit, they can roll with that very fluidly.
They can translate.
They can translate, man.
It's true.
And it
seems like important, though, to lift up the kind of moral courage that the Sharps are describing and to somehow acknowledge that people are coming in for particular reasons besides general spiritual sustenance. I would hope, at least, that the congregations would be engaged in the current conversations that are similar to what motivated the Sharps.
So I love that you brought that up. And it was so easy in some ways in those very difficult days to engage in something that we call evil. It was pretty obvious. Today, when we look at a lot of the same issues, it may not be the Germans exterminating the Jews, but it could be police officers killing young black men. It could be the brown people or the latest immigrant group trying to, you know, find some safe shelter. The same issues, and a lot of times you'll find that UUs and others can't get behind them. They don't see the correlation. The best thing we can do is take the movie and use it as a way to say, here's how that relates to today, you know. So,
John, your time with us was far too short. But we really appreciate you making the appearance, and I want to say thank you in absentia to Bill Schultz, president of the UUSC, for his time too. Although he had kind of an ungraceful transition out, we had a great time with him as well. Next week we are joined by some members of the Covenanting Task Group, the UUA Covenanting Task Group. Tom, you're involved in them, right? With them. Fabulous.
Yes, I am. It's a small group led by Susan Ritchie, convened by Jim Key on behalf of the board to consider new ways that congregations, people, subgroups can covenant together for more specific purposes around our mission, to try to become not so much agreeing that we agree to be members of an organization, but that we agree to pursue a larger mission together. So it's a very interesting group. But Elizabeth and Kathy, Elizabeth Mountain and Kathy Burek are coming, I believe.
Great. Well, thanks for joining us, everybody, who are watching online for another great week. And we'll see you next week.
This has been a podcast of The View, brought to you by the Church of the Larger Fellowship. To find out more about the CLF, visit questformeaning.org.